Hello and welcome back to season two of Unseen Incidents. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we've got our predictions for the brand new Premier League season. Liverpool, I don't think are going to win the league this season, but they could finish fifth if something goes wrong in a key zone, like, for instance, defensive midfield. Whereas if they get Caicedo, sit Caicedo there, McAllister does a bit of everything, and Szoboszlai is the most advanced in the midfield three, and suddenly, I think, everything makes sense. We reopen the burn book.
I don't think I've been more wrong about something in my life.
Damn.
Perhaps that is largely because I'm very rarely wrong. But as an invention, it is unbelievable.
While over on the subscription side, we're talking about Arsenal and Manchester United's big summers.
United were comfortably the lowest scorers in the top six. They're crying out for somebody else that comes in and just finishes the chances that are being created. Is that Højlund? Maybe. There's a good chance because he's got the right physicality level. He's fast, he's direct, he's good one-on-one.
Before we finish with our icks and our red flags in anything but football. That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. Okay, so we're back again. Pete Dorman.
Hello.
Back in the house. How are you?
Season two.
Sorry, that sound was me pouring my drink out. It's nice to see you. I haven't seen you for ages.
I know. It's after speaking to you at length every other week for an entire season almost, I kind of feel like we had a lot to catch up on, which, you know,
yeah, we
explains
did.
Why we spent almost half an hour just chatting before starting recording.
Yeah, that was all the good stuff. Now we can just get into like
all the boring
the
stuff.
The secondary content.
But yeah, I'm fine. I've got some beer. What do you have? It looks kind of like a Negroni.
It's actually non-alcoholic. Emma bought me for my birthday. My birthday just happened. I'm 34. You sent me very nice, happy birthday wishes. I've now surpassed Jesus's age. So, in your face. and we have more than 12 subscribers for this. So ultimately, like way ahead of Jesus.
Basically, deities in ourselves.
Exactly.
I've always said it.
It is, fuck, what's it called? It's like a bitter, it is kind of like a Negroni, or it's like a non-alcoholic Campari type thing. You know, like Chinotto or all those like little orangey red Italian glass bottles you see when you go into an Italian supermarket.
Yeah.
This is called San Bitter. And Emma got me a little crate of it for my birthday, and it comes in bottles that are 100 milliliters. Look how cute that is.
That is lovely.
It comes in... I'm not gonna say what I was about to say.
Is 100 milliliters the perfect serving for it, would you say? Because it's kind of bitter.
I don't know, man. Like, I think I really struggle when I'm holding a drink not to just drink it as if I'm trying to get it finished. So not for me personally. I brought two up here and I finished one while we were just chatting. So now I've really got to savor this one. I would say no. I'd say that I could do with, like, you know, 750 mil or something like that.
But a full wine.
Sorry, you've got a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I just stopped in the shop on the way home. Classic BrewDog KZG, and not sponsored, but, you know, they feature quite heavily on the Unseen Incidents podcast.
This is on you, though, because... For once, we were talking about seeing each other, and I actually was good and gave you a bunch of dates.
You did.
And this time it was on you who didn't get back to me. And so you could be here drinking one of these in my roasting hot loft.
Did you invite me around to record? Or I thought it was you didn't. I thought it was just to meet up for dinner or drinks. And in my defense, that's not really me being the impasse here. It's Jess being out of the country for 80% of this month. So blame her.
Korean Jess.
Jess.
She spent ages in Korea. That's not some coded reference. Yeah. No, I mean, maybe I would have done a recording with you, though. Maybe it's like, you know, if like The Rock was like, I'll spend the afternoon with you, then I'd be like, we should probably go to the gym. So, you know, if Pete Dorman comes over, you've got to record a podcast.
Drink and record,
All right, should we get into this then? Because we're going to talk about some predictions for the season. But we didn't just want to do like title winner, top scorer, not least because title winner and top scorer are probably like the two easiest predictions to make in the league. So we thought we'd do, in very traditional sort of like football Twitter, football YouTube style, some other stuff like dark horses, biggest flop. We've also got a positive one in there, which will be uncomfortable for all of us. So should we start with, I think we should start with best signing.
Best signing, okay.
Yeah, I think we should start there, then we should get negative, and then we should end with dark horses. So do you have a pick for the best signing of the summer? Because I've got to say, this summer, if I cared, which I don't, because last season was so long that like my fatigue has been quite high.
Yeah.
I think this has been one of the most interesting summers for a while. I think loads of teams have done really cool stuff. Some of the signings that have gone through have been amazing. Like, you've now got mid-table sides picking up genuinely cool players. I don't know. I just think it's a really fun... And then you've got, you know, like Lukaku kind of beefing with Inter and Juventus at the same time. And there's just so much like mayhem that it's actually been a really entertaining... Even today, the Harry Kane stuff that's going on, where suddenly Harry Kane is like, oh, well, I wanted to go.
But it's a bit late.
They've reached an agreement by his deadline. And you know that Harry Kane has just suddenly realised that he's got to like...
Move to Germany.
A house and move to Germany, like set up a new internet provider, like all that kind of stuff. Like, I need a new contract for my phone. And he's suddenly like, oh, you know what? I actually don't care. Yeah. I just want to say.
But yeah, I mean, it's been a really interesting summer so far. And I think the season's actually set up really interestingly because for the first time, in probably in living memory, like there are legit 8 teams that could finish in Europa League spots, probably 8 teams that could finish in Champions League spots.
Sure.
So I think the league this year will be really, really competitive. But my best signing pick, there obviously have been some big, big moves, but in terms of value for money and functionality or the fit for what I believe this team, how this team will play this season, my pick is Dominic Szoboszlai to Liverpool.
Ooh, goddamn.
Because
that's quite punchy.
Because I mean, obviously I dislike Liverpool intensely, but credit where credit's due, I really rate this transfer because I've openly voiced my concerns about their creation from central. I've voiced my concerns about their midfield. I've voiced my concerns about Alexis McAllister, and I still stand by that I don't think he brings that much to Liverpool. Personally. But with Szoboszlai, I really, really like the signing. You know, £60 million, fair bit of money, but considering McAllister's fee could rise to 55, I'm kind of okay with 60 mil. And when you look at the price, obviously Szoboszlai's more attacking, but when you look at the price that a lot of midfielders are going for now, Rice, 105, Caicedo is, you know, maybe going for 100, you know, Enzo Fernandez, even Casemiro, coming in for 70 mil last season. Like central midfielders, granted a lot of those are defensive midfielders, but central midfield at the minute is just a really expensive position to buy from. So I think 60 mil is fair in this current market. And what's really interesting about Szoboszlai is that he's so, so versatile. So he was kind of in and out of Leipzig's starting lineup in his first season, but he was a proper mainstay last season. But in the 4,000 minutes he's played for them, his most frequent position is CAM, centre attack and midfield. But that only equates to 25% of his minutes.
Okay.
So if you break down his minutes, 25% CAM, 25% right mid, and then like 17, 12, 11% all kind of around central midfield, right midfield, or left midfield. He can pretty much play anywhere in the front six bar striker. I think he did play a couple of games for Leipzig at striker, but he is super, super versatile. And I think his kind of most natural position is a right-sided attacking midfielder, but not a winger, if that makes sense. Because he's not like super explosive. He's not that fast in terms of like acceleration. He's not a big dribbler. So he's not really going to gas guys down the line and send in balls from deep. He kind of just gravitates in towards that inside channel and creates from there with like really intelligent weighted through balls and stuff. And when you think about how Liverpool started to play at the end of last season, similar to how City played as well, in that 3-box-3 in transition, where they pushed a defender into midfield and then kind of played with 2 10s. City did it with Stones, whereas Liverpool did it by inverting Trent. He looks really, really good and a really good profile for that kind of right-sided attacking midfielder in a 3-box-3 system, where Liverpool, which I think Liverpool will look to do that a lot more this season. And I'm pretty sure Klopp's already said that Trent will have a lot more reign in midfield this season than he has in previous. I think he's really looking to utilize him a lot more in that kind of central midfield role, whether that's actually as a central midfielder or as a, you know, a central midfielder in transition, inverting from right back. That remains to be seen. But Szoboszlai just looks like a really, really good fit for that kind of attacking role. And, you know, his creation numbers are good. You know, his 2.6 chances per 90, he was ninth in the Bundesliga last year. If you just look at that in open play chances created, he was like 11th. His shot creating actions are really promising too. You know, 60% of them are from open play passes, which I think is quite significant, because one of my biggest criticisms of Alexis McAllister was that his shot creating actions were largely coming from him taking shots, or a large portion of them were coming from him taking shots, which is fine at Brighton, but I do not think will fly in a Klopp system that is, you know, a highly elite technical system that values possession. Also, you know, like McAllister's shots were coming from like 24 yards out on average.
Though I think that's less true now, right, though? Because like Nunez and Gakpo are both guys who actually had very, very low pass completion, like before they came to Liverpool. And I mean, obviously you don't want everyone in the side to have low pass completion. Like some people need to be solid on the ball. But it does feel like the team last year was much more kind of, we are going to try low percentage balls and accept that we will have relatively low pass accuracy, rather than in the past where it was like this really finely honed system of moving parts.
Sure, but I don't think that last season was what they were necessarily aiming or planning to do going forward. I think maybe there's a middle ground in between, but I think there's also a difference between playing a low percentage ball and taking a low percentage shot, or repeatedly taking a low percentage shot, because I kind of feel like a low percentage ball, you're still trying to create. You're still trying to get players like Nunez on good chances. Whereas I think if you know, I'm not, whether he does or not, but if McAllister starts taking like loads of shots from 25 yards out with super low XG, that gets tiring quite quickly, in my opinion. A lot quicker than trying kind of flashier, low percentage creative passes.
Yeah, and no one's actually really done that from the midfield. Like, I mean, in the past, I used to get a lot of shit for it, but like, I would point out that in the Henderson, Fabinho, Wijnaldum midfield, nobody got shots.
Yeah.
Nobody. And last year, nobody in the midfield got shots either. And actually, what's kind of interesting about Szoboszlai is that he does get a lot of shots from a kind of midfield
role.
He's
got an absolute cannon as well.
Yeah, and I think you'd be happier with him shooting from range than most people. But and plus, if he's kind of going out wide at certain points, Salah comes inside. But I think you're right in the sense that like Klopp's plan is not necessarily let's get more shots from the midfield. I think he'll say let's get more shots for our actual attackers.
Yes,
like Salah, for instance, last season lost a whole shot from the year before. Mm. I think he came down to 3.3 from 4.3. Well, you want Salah getting that extra shot rather than McAllister taking it. Yeah, I agree.
So, like, having that extra bit of creation in... And also, like, because he's so versatile, he does kind of float... He has the ability to float about, like you just said. He can float wide. You can be a lot more fluid with a player like Szoboszlai in that 3-box-3 formation. And his creation numbers are good. His general role will be to get Salah chances, to get Nunez chances, to be, you know, and the thing is, what's interesting when you watch him play, the chances he creates aren't like they don't seem like he's just sticking a ball into an area and see what happens. It seems a lot more cultured than that. It seems balls seem a lot more weighted. They seem a lot more intelligent, kind of more similar to the way like De Bruyne creates. Obviously, there's still a substantial gap between the two, but I feel him and McAllister, if they're going to be those two kind of midfielders that push forward, obviously Thiago's still there as well, but if they're going to be those two players that push forward, I'm kind of fine with that. I'm a lot more fine with McAllister being there if he's alongside a player like Szoboszlai, because McAllister no longer has to carry all of the creation, which he, in my opinion, is not capable of doing.
Agreed.
So he can just be kind of like a decent Premier League standard body in there that kind of carries the water between whoever's in DM and kind of Szoboszlai maybe a little bit more advanced on the right side, and just kind of shores up everything else while that goes on, and maybe creates a bit, does what he can, chips in where he can, but Szoboszlai will be that kind of main attacking threat from central. And I think it just makes sense for them. The money is not cheap, but it's, I think it's a fair price. You know, he's a good age, his numbers are good, he's coming from a decent league, his defensive numbers are not amazing, but they're fine. He's not a passenger defensively. Leipzig, I think only Bayern were a more aggressively pressing side in the Bundesliga than them last year, so he's comfortable in a side that the press is hard and high. And I think he just kind of slots perfectly into that, the way I think Klopp and Liverpool will play next season.
Yeah, I think I feel more positive about him, though, if they keep Fabinho or get Caicedo.
Well, Fabinho's gone, isn't he, already?
Lavia. I didn't think it was confirmed, but maybe it has been now. It now looks like they're going to try and get Caicedo instead of trying to get
Lavia.
That
was today, wasn't it?
And where it was suddenly Chelsea had made a bid for Lavia and Liverpool had made a bid for Caicedo. Yeah. But I think, Lavia's got talent, but you do not want him starting. And no matter how bad Fabinho was last season, starting Lavia 38 games this season would probably be worse. He's still extremely patchy. He's got loads of talent, but I just don't want him starting for my team if my team is kind of the second or third best team in the league, but there are a bunch of teams underneath that could easily take away a Champions League place. Like Liverpool, I don't think are going to win the league this season, but they could finish fifth if something goes wrong in a key zone, like, for instance, defensive midfield. Whereas if they get Caicedo, sit Caicedo there, McAllister does a bit of everything, and Szoboszlai is the most advanced in the midfield three, and suddenly I think everything makes sense.
I think they absolutely need to go for Caicedo, though, because Fabinho has gone. So, like, their defense...
They have to do it, then.
So, pretty much, their defensive midfield options are Stefan Bajicic, who's, 18, 19?
Yeah, something like that.
Thiago Alcantara.
Great, but never fit.
And a repurposed Trent, if they choose to play him as DM.
And if you're willing to go to, like, 45 for Lavia, just add the Fabinho money in and go for Caicedo. Yeah. Like, it's really straightforward, and Caicedo is a quality defensive midfielder who's great on the ball right now, whereas Lavia is a guy who is very easy to watch and dream on, but he is a project. Yeah,
but
like, if you were going to get Lavia,
everybody's saying that, like, just go for Caicedo. And I think I think they were resistant to it, but after looking at their squad and who they signed, they're like, we need a player that will make an impact now.
And that's a midfield that can play together forever.
But like, if you look at like that transition, like midfield of Caicedo, Trent, McAllister, Szoboszlai, that's pretty nice.
And the attack was great last season. Even when Liverpool were crap last season, the attack was always good. And now that attack is going to be some combination of Diaz, Salah, Nunez, Gakpo, Jota. And then you've got other people who can rotate in, you know, like you've got some depth around midfield and attacking mid, like Elliot and Jones and blah, blah,
and also,
blah. Like Thiago as well.
Yeah. When you think about some of Liverpool's biggest problems last year, almost all of them exist around their midfield, in my opinion. And then they've gone out, say they do get Caicedo, they'll have gone out and signed three central midfielders. So, like, fair enough.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's been a good summer for them. If they end up with someone like Lavia to replace Fabinho, I think it'd be a bad summer for them. Like, I really do. That's such a key
role. Knife edge. Yeah. No, it is.
Yeah, you can't mess around with that role. And I think that people talking about how bad Fabinho was last season, I think there's part of this as well where people always get confused about a young player with star potential, how good that guy actually is. Because quite often there's like a 19-year-old with star potential, but they are generally not as good as just a 25-year-old, yeah, like Premier League midfielder, because the standard in the Premier League is, yeah, so high. So even a bad Fabinho, I think you would rather have in your side than like a 19-year-old Lavia. Maybe not in the long term,
it's
but
safer
in
though
one or
season,
two seasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I agree with you. I think it's a really fun one. I think Liverpool are going to be dangerous this season.
Yeah.
Seriously dangerous. I could easily see them pipping Arsenal to second. I find it hard to imagine them coming below fourth unless they don't get this DM, or unless like there's just a crazy injury.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like say,
or unless the defense doesn't get fixed. You know, the defense, yeah, still needs to be fixed.
I can see them finishing anywhere between sixth and second.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fun in itself.
Yeah, agreed. All right, my best signing. I also love Szoboszlai. I love Onana to Man United.
Yeah.
I love Moussa Diaby to Villa. I think Nkunku, when he gets fit again,
yeah,
if he gets fit again, because meniscus injury is a bit dodgy,
yeah,
he's kind of the one guy in that Chelsea team where I'm like, maybe you can make this work.
Yeah.
Because he was just like amazing as a forward last season. He was amazing at everything. And he gets loads of shots. And basically nobody there gets lots of shots. Raheem Sterling doesn't get a lot of shots. Jackson didn't get a lot of shots last season. Maybe he will this year. But I mean, like,
they don't have a centre forward. So,
yeah. Exactly. There's nobody there who just gets like a bunch of shots. And I think Nkunku maybe could be that. But assuming it gets done, Mohamed Kudus to Brighton is one of my favourites. He's 23, which is actually a little bit older than I thought. But when you look at his stats, or you just watch footage of him,
mm-hmm,
in the Eredivisie, it's literally impossible to work out what he's best at or what he's meant to be doing. Like, if you watch a video, I was watching a video of him the other day, and I saw him pick up the ball in central midfield, exchange a couple of passes and burst into the box. Then I saw him pulling out on the left wing and delivering a cross. Then I saw him on the right wing beating his man. Then I saw him in like the kind of number 10 space, tackling someone and winning the ball back. I was just like, what is going on with this guy? And he's so good at so many things that even if he only ends up being really good at like two of those things, he will be a really good player. And actually at Brighton, you tend to get maximised. Like, Danny Welbeck,
for sure,
last season was 11th in the Premier League for expected goals and assists per 90. And Ferguson was in the top 20 as well. Now, Ferguson's talented, but he's 18. Danny Welbeck's talented, but he's old.
Danny Welbeck was 11th in the league for XG.
Expected goals and assists per 90, yes. He was 11th.
He scored like 8 league goals last year.
Yeah, but he's good, man. Like, he's Danny Welbeck's always been good. But more importantly, Brighton just juice your numbers. Mm. Like, Brighton get guys,
absolutely,
on the ball, you know, like, and the thing is, they don't just do it because, you know, like, through some witchcraft. Like, these are really good players as well. Danny Welbeck is a smart player and a good player in a right position in the right team. Ferguson's obviously super talented. Mitoma is amazing. Kudus is the kind of signing that a team that had such a special campaign last year absolutely should be making. He's obviously played in a possession side. He's got great intensity. And according to FBref, he's in the top 5% of attackers for shots, expected goals, pass completion, dribbles, and touches in the box. Last year, he was completing 5 dribbles a game. The year before, 5 dribbles a game. And contributing to 5 shots, you know, through both creating the shots and taking them.
Yeah.
So I mean, that is like hyper, hyper, hyper elite. And he's an amazing outlet, receives loads of outlet passes. He's fast. He gets fouled a lot. He can play wide. If you could, I mean, Solly March had an amazing season. I would be a bit loath to bench Solly March. But they could play Kudus in the McAllister role.
I was going to say,
be like,
yeah,
right, your job is to get in there. But at the same time, they've got Nciso, so maybe sometimes they're like, okay, Kudus, like, you're going to play on the right wing, and Solly March isn't, you know. Okay, today you're going to cover for Mitoma. Today you're maybe going to play up front. That'd be interesting. Like, he can basically do everything by the looks of things, and almost nobody comes out of, like, the Eredivisie and can do, you know, as much as they could there in the Prem. Like, it's like,
I mean, just look at fucking
Suarez,
Anthony,
Van Persie, people like that. No, yeah, what a player. but I just think, like, for Brighton to get a player like this from Ajax is actually low-key, like, quite a big statement. And
what, like a flex?
Yeah, like, yeah. He's one of Ajax's best players. And he's going from Ajax, one of the greatest clubs in the world. Like, one of maybe, I mean, would argue...
Historically, but sure.
Okay, but if there were two football clubs that invented football as it exists today,
yeah,
I would say they're Barcelona and Ajax. And
so Johan Cruyff, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. So Johan Cruyff and Rinus Michels. But it's like, I don't know. He's just going to be... I think at the very least, he's going to be really useful in Europe, because last season, seven appearances between the Champions League, I think six in the Champions League, one in the Europa League, and he got eight goal involvements in that time. Mm. If you have Mitoma and Kudus on either wing, and then Ferguson up front, and then Nciso behind them, and who knows, there's no guarantee they'll lose Caicedo, but even if they lose Caicedo, I quite like their signings. I like Dahoud, you know, I think Milner's, you know, useful.
They'll also have 100 mil to play with if they lose Caicedo.
Sure. It doesn't take much to imagine this side, like, being great. It really doesn't. Like, if you just have two elite wingers, that is the kind of thing that top four charges are made of. Now, I'm not saying that will necessarily happen, but if we could fast forward suddenly to May and Brighton are third, I'm not that surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if, like, United, you know, had problems. I wouldn't be surprised if Newcastle had a bit of, you know, a sticky time. I wouldn't be surprised if Liverpool had issues in the defensive midfield zone. Like, it doesn't actually take that much, because Brighton were as good as all those sides last season. Exactly. And now that, and so if they lose Colwill and Caicedo, that's a big loss. But on the other hand, Ferguson a year older, Mitoma for the whole year, somebody like Kudus. I don't know. What I put in my notes here was like, name the Premier League clubs that you think are guaranteed to be better than Brighton this season.
Man City.
Yeah.
Arsenal. Arsenal.
I would probably say Arsenal as well, but it's not as clear cut as I'd like it to be.
I think the
Rice, if they lose Caicedo, yeah.
I think, yeah, that, but also I think the Rice addition to Arsenal is substantial. And also Arsenal's youth, a year older. It should theoretically be not as good as last season, because last season might have been a bit purple. But yeah, I think Arsenal will be not substantially better than Brighton, but yeah, better than Brighton. And then the rest is kind of really just a toss up. You know, United are pretty unknown. Liverpool should be a lot better this season than they were last season, at least how they started last season. They finished pretty well. Chelsea, fuck knows. Honestly, no idea about Chelsea.
Spurs, honestly, no idea.
No idea. Don't think so. I think Spurs will finish mid-table. Yeah, I think, like, Brighton are legitimately up there. And if I was Brighton and I finished the league outside of Europe, I would be disappointed. Like, really disappointed.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, people are talking about, like, Villa as top four contenders. Like, I'm sorry, like, I like Villa's summer, but they were running hot last season. Maybe it happens again. I just don't think they're as good as they looked down the stretch last year.
Yeah.
They also took some beatings in that time, you know, like against Arsenal, for instance, they ended up losing like 4-2. But I think they got fucking hammered on XG. Mm. It was like 3.3 to 0.3. Like, there were games like that where it was like, oh, you know, Villa are pushing like good teams, and you were kind of like, no, they're not. Whereas Brighton, I was just like, if Brighton were in the Champions League, no one would want to play them. It'd be horrible to play them. In the same way that no one should want to play Newcastle. Horrible to play Newcastle. So, I don't know. I just think Brighton are sick, and I think Kudus is, if I were running Brighton, I'd be like, let's let's go and get Kudus and just see what happens. Like, let's push the boat out, spend 40 mil. We've made some crazy sales over the last few years. Let's spend 40 mil on him. And, like, let's like, get this fucking thing out on, like, the open road and see what we can do.
Yeah.
And also, let's get it out on the Autobahn.
And also, like, in terms of slightly less flashy additions, they've added some good players as well. You know, like, while Pedro's come in for 30 mil. I suppose that, to be sure. Fair, I say less flashy, that's their club record signing. But
yeah,
he's come in and
he's a project, yeah.
Yeah, and he had a decent season last season. And I think he's again another versatile player, can play in any of those forward positions, and just adds kind of like another string to Brighton's bow. And then, yeah, I think they'll lose Caldwell because I don't think Chelsea want to sell him on a permanent. He'll go back.
Not.
But they did get Igor from Fiorentina, who I think is, again, as a honorary Florentine, we all know. I, again, rate him as a really decent top-level central defender. You know, he got like 3,000 minutes for Fiorentina last year in a season where Fiorentina...
God damn.
And all comps. It's like 2,000 in the league. But
okay,
3,000 all comps. But like, that's a season where Fiorentina went to the Italian Cup final, Europa League conference final, finished eighth in Serie A, but behind like all the teams you'd expect them to finish.
Mm.
They're essentially the best of the rest.
Yeah.
And he's just a solid centre-back. He also played left-back, so he can provide cover for Estepan. It's just signing that makes sense considering Brighton now have European football. And we'll add, like, you know, another 10, 12 games to their season just by getting that. 10 or 12, maybe that's a bit punchy. Going to fucking win Europa League. But yeah. Yeah, I think, obviously, we may as well roll this in now because we've gone extensive in on Brighton. But my dark horse is Brighton. And we're on that. And to be fair, you've covered almost exclusively most of the things I've put down. So congratulations on your thorough research. But yeah, I think Evan Ferguson could have a breakout season. Like, he seems like an incredible talent. He only had 950 minutes in the league last year, but 6 goals, 10 starts. I have a feeling that for him, this, based on how he played last season and when you watched him play and how he kind of looked on the pitch, granted, again, under 1,000 minutes in the league, but still, how he looked last season was super promising, and I would not be surprised at all if this is like a really big breakout season for him.
Yeah, yeah. And then Ciso, Buonanotte, like, I mean, they're just always these guys they've got. They've got somebody else as well. They signed some other, like, weird guy I'd never heard of. Like, they're always just doing interesting stuff. And, like, a whole year of De Zerbi, like...
I mean...
And genuinely elite talent.
They lost... There. Obviously, they lost Sanchez as well, but they've replaced him with a keeper from Anderlecht, the 20-year-old. Don't know a huge amount about him, but again, like...
Verbruggen.
Yeah. I don't know a huge amount about him, but, like... One thing that Brighton kind of have earned the right to over the, you know, past almost decade now is that when they sign young and not big household names, they generally do it pretty well. Or their record of hits is pretty staggering. I mean, I don't know a huge amount about him, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was a very, very solid keeper. And then, yeah, like you say, De Zerbi is just a really, really good manager. Since his first game, which was, I think, the start of October last year, Brighton are third for expected points behind City, Newcastle, and third by XG behind Liverpool City. And only Arsenal and City have scored more than them since De Zerbi managed his first Premier League game. He's just a good Premier League manager who knows how to set up his squad and get the absolute most out of what he has. And I don't think people give Brighton anywhere near the amount of respect that they actually deserve right now. Because if you look at the progression as well, 17th, 15th, 16th, 9th, 6th.
I know, it's crazy. And they could have finished 4th. They could have finished 4th. Like, and also bear in mind that we were kind of like, Caicedo had barely played going into last season. And then right at the beginning of the season, they lost Mwepu. Like, do you remember Mwepu was like one of their star players, and then he retired from football because of his heart condition.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in Weipo goes, like, okay, Trossard gets benched before he gets sold, but Trossard was one of their best players the season before. They knew McAllister was probably exiting, and McAllister had like a really long, grueling World Cup. They just, you know, they actually benched Sanchez as well. They obviously had sold Mopé. Like, there are guys who'd been starting quite a bit for them over the previous few years. Then even down the stretch at the end, you know, like, Arsenal can talk about some of the injuries they had and how it destabilized the back line. But some of the stuff that De Zerbi was having to do in his fullback zones as the season went on was like pretty creative stuff. You know, like he was playing like Pascal Gross at right back and stuff. Yeah. Like there was all sorts of weird kind of shenanigans happening there. And it was just like amazing managerial creativity. And during that stretch, they slapped Arsenal. They took points off City. You know, admittedly, City were like on the deck chairs a bit by then, but like they were amazing. They were the best team in the league towards the end of the season, you know, after City won the title. And they were just, and they have done it playing incredible football. I don't know. I think Brighton will be one of the most watchable sides in the league this season.
Yeah.
If I wasn't supporting Arsenal, I'd support Brighton. And you know what? Like at the end of the season, if there are under 5 points between Brighton and Arsenal, it wouldn't surprise me. Admittedly, Caicedo going affects that does affect my my kind of prediction, because what we've really praised them for is how they've succession planned.
Yeah.
I don't know how much they have succession planned for Caicedo, because Caicedo kind of was the succession plan.
Like the very end of my section here was like the last point is a lot of this. My call for them being dark horses rides on their Caicedo replacement. Whether they even have one or not.
Sure.
Yeah, that is the one unknown. And that kind of like, I think a lot of their season kind of hinges on it. Everything's pointing towards him going. Sure, I can see him not going, but I think he will.
I think he will as well. But they've known that since January. So if he does go...
Well, they've known he might go.
They must have an idea for what they're actually going to do. And I mean, they brought in Mahmoud Dahoud, obviously. They've got some other stuff. I mean, Alzate's coming back, isn't he? From his loan to Standard Liège. But I mean, he's 24. Like, is he about to be a star? Like,
I rate Dahoud. I like the signing. But Caicedo's ability to win the ball is far superior than Dahoud. Like, Dahoud is really good at disrupting play, but not really good at winning back possession. Dahoud is more of a progressive passer than both Caicedo and McAllister. But it feels like Dahoud is a better replacement for a McAllister type role, maybe not as advanced, but his skill set seems to lend itself perhaps more to what like the hole that McAllister leaves versus the hole that in terms of skill set, at least, not necessarily
it'd be interesting.
Specific position, but like the hole that Caicedo will leave.
I would have thought that if Caicedo goes, they will have something that they will do with the money quite quickly.
Mm.
But they also, in January, brought in a Yasin Ayari, the Swedish midfielder from AIK. Like I don't think they're going to want to start him every game this season, but like maybe they just think he's the next guy up. And
yeah.
Brighton's track record when they think someone's the guy is pretty hard. On. So, I mean, I don't know. I just think... Even if they are weak in defensive midfield this season, if Caicedo goes, they've got enough talent in other places that they're going to be a huge danger anyway.
Like, I really fucking rate Lewis Dunk.
Yeah, me too.
I really rate him. And I genuinely think he's a leading Premier League centre-back, and he just doesn't get the credit.
No, he is, for sure.
And I just don't think he gets the credit. And
I love Webster. I love Dunk.
Yeah.
I like Estupiñán.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Like, you can't argue with Brighton being dark horses. I kind of thought about Liverpool, but to be honest, I don't think they're going to win the league. And I think, you know, in most predictions, people have actually been putting them third. So that's, you know, kind of what I think.
Yeah.
A lot of picks for Villa. I don't really see it for Chelsea. United, I had a think about. Really did have a strong think about United. So I thought I'd take a swing and I'll go for Spurs.
Ooh.
Now, Spurs, I think, have... just like huge variance here. So Spurs might have a horrendous season. Like they might, the wheels might come off. They might play like shit. Like they've basically got no proper fullbacks. They've got like wing backs and everything might just be a disaster. But if things click, I think that there's quite a that there's quite an interesting lineup to be had here.
It's a big if.
I think that even if Kane stays, which he shouldn't, they should absolutely sell him. And the fact that there are like Spurs fans celebrating that he might stay, like that,
the fact that they rejected like that whatever 100 mil bid at the first time is mental.
I know, they're so stupid, man. But like, but to be fair, it seems like Levy all along was like, I'm going to get as much money as we can and then I'll sell him. But I look at the team and I think Højbjerg is still meant to go. Don't know if he actually will now. But Bissouma and eventually Bentancur in central midfield and Pape Mata Sarr, they've got an attack now that even without Kane would look like Son, Richarlison and Kulusevski with Madison behind them. And that's and also there are rumours they're going to go and try and get Gift Orban if Kane goes, which would be pretty cool. And then, you know, I don't like all their business. Like, I really hate Manor Solomon. I think he was crap last season at Fulham. Or I don't think he was crap. I think his underlying numbers were crap. And I think he was on a hot finishing streak. And I think that Spurs have been sucked in by it. I wouldn't have done it. But Van de Ven, I think, is good. It's a good bet. It's a lot of money. It's going to be like 40 mil. But it's a good bet. He's a left-footed centre-back. Great. Go for it. I like that they've gone and got Alejo Veliz, this 19-year-old Argentinian striker. 15 mil for a 19-year-old Argentinian striker. Again, if I were a director of football, those are the sorts of things I'd do probably once a season. Like any summer where we didn't spend our entire transfer budget on players for the first team, I'd be like, do we have 10 mil? Let's just pick up a couple of like talents from South America. Yeah.
Just roll the dice.
Exactly. Like, it's basically what teams like Brighton do. And then you're like, we loan you out. We take you to first team training. We like shepherd you through the academy, and eventually you might be a star, and if you're not, we could probably sell you for like 5 mil to somebody else. Like,
take a 10 mil loss, fucking sick.
Exactly. Like, it's just zero. It's zero risk, really. And if he's great, he's great. I mean, I don't think the attack will be as bad even without Kane. I actually think the attack might be better purely because there'll be more bodies in attack. And the attack was horrible last season.
I think it'll be more functional. I don't know if it'll be better.
Yeah,
and just because of how many goals Kane scores.
No, but that's all it needs to be. Like, if you have a functioning attack, if you run your attack through one guy, unless that guy's like Messi or Ronaldo, it doesn't matter really how good he is. You're not going to have an elite attack. It just won't happen. Like City, okay, like Haaland scored a lot of goals, but like City's attack was completely functional in lots of other ways. And the season before, they won the league with like no striker, like, and when they played with Alvarez, they look still incredible.
I think actually the last Haaland was the first striker to score over 20 league goals and win the league since Van Persie.
God damn, really?
Yeah.
Did Vardy not get 20?
Or maybe it was more. Maybe it's 25. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's 25.
But,
yeah.
The point that I can't remember whose article it was, but the Athletic were making was that to win the league, you don't necessarily need somebody to score like Haaland. For the last 10 years, the best teams have shared a lot of the goals in terms of in league winning campaigns, have shared a lot of the scoring burden. So it's not just about one player getting 80% of your forward line goals. In actual fact,
and I think
it's
defense
detrimental,
is,
arguably.
Yeah, I think defenses are sophisticated enough now that, like, if you've got one guy and he's your danger man, then teams can to some degree suppress you. You know, like, yes, Kane got loads and loads and loads of goals last season because Kane's amazing, but like, did Tottenham have a good attack? No, they didn't. This season they'll have more Porro, who I actually think is a good attacking wing back. I wouldn't want to play him in a back four. They've got Udoji coming in, who's a good two-way wing back on the left. I think that front line is good, and if they add a striker to it, even better. Richarlison was at 0.5 expected goals per 90 last year, so he's not going to be this crap forever. Son, who everyone was like, my God, Son, you know, he's in serious decline, still got 16 goal involvements, perfectly respectable. I just kind of like it. I think I would probably have to play three at the back, which I guess does mean dropping one of those attackers.
Yeah, well, their entire defensive setup in terms of personnel is built for three at the back. Like, I don't see how they play four at the back.
Yeah, and Romero plays it. Yeah, Romero plays in three at the back. Van de Ven will be better in the three at the back. The wing backs will be. It'll help the central midfielders. But then you've got But that means also that's good in the sense that you're not playing all your good attackers. You'll always have one on the bench, which actually is what you want. So I don't know, like, and I think if Kane goes as well, they'll buy somebody. Plus, it'll lower expectations for Ange. And I think low expectations, you know, everyone's like, Kane's gone, you know, end of an era, my God, you know, who have we got left from like the golden age? But it's like Dyer and Son. Like, oh, this is so sad, blah, blah, blah. Well, you've got probably a better goalkeeper. You've got a real attacking midfielder for the first time since Eriksen. You've got really exciting wingbacks, Jed Spence back as well. You've got a midfielder in Sarr who looked amazing, amazing as a teenager in France. I don't think it's that hard to just see them being pretty good. Like, I don't think they're top four good, but who knows? Like, if other teams explode, it's completely possible. Now, I think they could also be really bad, but I don't really see a terrible Spurs being as bad as people think it might be. I still think this is a really decent squad, and I think Ange Postecoglou seems like a good manager. So I don't know. I think they'll have a solid year, consolidate, go and get one or two more next summer. And if you get those transfers right, if they buy a striker and he bangs, and I mean bangs like 15 goals, like that'd be amazing. Then suddenly you think, you know what? We're actually like two places away again. It's really easy for these things to, if you've got really quality squad parts around, it's quite easy to turn a crisis team into a good team if you've got a good manager and you make the a couple of right signings. So I don't know. Yeah. I'm acknowledging here that Spurs might be terrible this season.
Yeah,
but I think the upside on Spurs is higher than a lot of people want to admit.
I'm a lot more pessimistic about them. I take your point and I see where you're coming from.
That's
but I just don't see it this season. I can see it maybe next season, season after, but this season, I think, with how competitive the kind of top 6 to 8 teams are, I think they're doing well to finish above 7th or 7th. I think you know, they're finishing somewhere between 11th and 8th, I think, is where they're going to finish.
Okay.
I think this is a real transitional year. New manager, lost their talisman and Kane, don't have the right personnel defensively for the system that Ange will want to play. So somebody's going to have to make, something's going to have to give there, either the system or the players. Like, yeah, I just think, considering how competitive this season I think will be and how good, like, teams who have had down seasons, like Liverpool, won't have a down season again. Teams like Newcastle, Brighton, Villa to a lesser extent, are on the up and now really, really competitive against the top of the table. Yeah, I see Spurs kind of just... I mean, 11th is a really bad season, but yeah, I can see them finishing 8th.
I'm trying to put up the table from last season just because, like, I don't know, man. That would be pretty nuts. Like, whatever. Anyway, it's just annoying me. My internet's being crap. But I don't think it takes that much to get you out of there. And in the same way that we're saying, you know, one or two key players on other sides, I think that sometimes we overrate the best players on crap sides and we underrate the best players on good sides, you know, because we're like, oh, well, they're Spurs, you know, like, so a guy like Maddison just fits in. Maddison's fucking amazing. Maddison's really good. If he gets another year like last year and, you know, last year it was basically him and Harvey Barnes and a bit of Iheanacho and that was kind of it. Well, this season he'll have Richarlison, Son and Kulusevski around him, like, plus the wingbacks. I don't know. Like, if I were Maddison, I'd be like, this is going to be amazing. Yeah, okay, we'll see. We'll see. But there's a part of me that thinks, depending on the odds, if you gave me, you know, will Spurs finish higher than this team? Will Spurs finish higher than that team? Like, there are quite a few teams where everyone's like, oh, well, you know, like Villa are in a way better position than Spurs. Are they? Spurs, I'd expect to finish above Villa like 8 times out of 10. Maybe that's high. Maybe 7.
That's kind of high. Yeah.
But I don't know. That's how I feel. Anyway, that's how I feel. Should we move on to biggest flop then before we get to the burn book?
Do you want me to go first?
I can go first. I could do mine quickly.
Mine's quite quick as well. I'll go first.
Okay.
Sure, because mine, Mine comes with caveats and a substantial amount of caveats. So this is...
It's cowardice.
Do you think so?
I just did it with Spurs.
I appreciate the honesty, but it comes with a reasonable amount of caveats, or at least context. So my biggest flop of this season is Rasmus Højlund.
God. Okay.
Right. Should I elaborate? No.
Yeah.
I'll keep this predominantly top line and get through it, because we will go into his underlying stats in more detail on the Patreon side. So if you are interested in that, please do subscribe. But my reason for selecting Højlund is because he's so young. He is so unproven. His sample size in a top five league is so small. He only had 20 starts for Atalanta. He's such an unproven talent. It's a lot of money. It's a much more competitive league. And the expectations put on him, because one, because of the money, two, because United have been without a significant investment in central, in a number nine for so long. If you think about it, realistically, the last real investment as a number nine in the number nine role was Romelu Lukaku in 2017. I'm not including. I'm not. Well. Who else is there? Like, Ronaldo was there.
Cavani was free, right?
Cavani was either free or loan. I can't remember. Then you've got Weghorst. You've got Odion Ighalo. You've got Ronaldo, which Ronaldo was never long term. It was, you know, sure, right?
2 years,
like not even a year and a half after the fucking Piers Morgan interview. Mm-hmm. So United really haven't invested in a number nine since Lukaku in 2017, and we've been crying out for one, like an established goal scoring number nine, for so long. Martial, inconsistent, can't stay fit. Rashford doesn't want to play as a nine, wants to play off the left. So the fact that we've now finally got a big money signing at number nine, a lot of people can get carried away. A lot of people can be like, this guy is going to fix United. This is what we've been waiting for five seasons.
Mm.
And you can very easily forget, like you said earlier, a 19-year-old that looks really good might not be as good as a 25-year-old who just knows what to do in whatever. Yeah. He's just a more cultured, experienced player. And obviously, Højlund is, you know, Scandinavian, an attacker, very big, blonde hair, physical.
He is big.
Fast.
He is big.
He's not quite as big as Haaland. I think he's 2 inches smaller. But there are a lot of comparisons that both physically and like kind of the way they play, the way they look. You know, even the fees weren't too dissimilar. Haaland was like 50 mil. Højlund was 60, 65, maybe raising to above 70. All of these comparisons kind of occur quite naturally. But the problem with that is that Haaland is the exception to every rule that's ever been made. But
yeah. And Højlund was only so cheap because he was...
It was a release clause, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah. So my problem with this is also because you can't compare him to Haaland, because Haaland breaks every rule. Haaland is just a freak. And I also don't think Haaland will score at the same rate this season than he did last season. I think he will have a more of a down season. I think he'll still probably win the Golden Boot, definitely if Kane goes. But
yeah,
I don't see him scoring 50 goals all comp. I don't actually know what
he'll probably have an injury period or something. Yeah, or a slump.
His, what, 30? He finished on 36 goals?
36.
Yeah. You know, I can see that going down to like 28, 26.
Yeah.
But still winning the Golden Boot. Still a good season. But Højlund comes into the United team 3 years younger than... He's 3 years younger than Haaland. He arrives in the Prem 2 years before Haaland did. At this age, Haaland just signed for Dortmund. Mm. So the learning curve is steeper for Højlund. You know, those two seasons that Haaland had at Dortmund were not essential to his development, but really important. Like, it allowed him to...
Definitely.
Yeah, like... I'm not saying he wouldn't have been the player he is now had he not done that, had he come straight to the Prem, but, you know, they were really important in his development and kind of allowed him to build up to a Premier League standard across two seasons, and then come at 22 years old, 23 years old, 22, I think he was, and just smash it. We are 2 years south of that with Højlund, so I think he will take at least a season, maybe two, maybe three seasons to kind of start hitting consistent numbers at the top level, at Premier League level. And I think he'll be fine. I think he'll have a fine season. But the reason I've selected him as flop is because I think, because of the fee, because of the comparisons to Haaland, because of the, you know, the lack of quality or depth at central forward that United have had for so many years. Fine to a lot of onlookers, both fans and rivals, a fine season from Højlund looks bad. Looks like a flop. It looks like an underperformance. Because for me, if he scores 10, 15 goals, all comps, that's a fantastic first season. But it feels like if he gets anywhere south of like low 20s, people will be like, waste of money. They'll forget he's 19.
Yeah, I mean, United are bad about this.
United are awful about this. Remember, we had three title runs last year, Patrick. We had three separate title charges.
They didn't go up.
Yeah.
If he got, yeah, I guess I can't work out like whether I'm thinking United. Then again, United fans were defending Antony last season. Antony cost more and was worse than I would expect Højlund to be.
I just think
if Højlund gets like 10 goals in the league, that'd be great.
Yeah, well, I said,
and if he plays the whole year up front, I think he probably will.
I think he'll pretty much get the majority of minutes at number nine, either because he deserves it, or because you're kind of obliged to because you paid so much for him, or just by circumstance because Anthony Martial's injured again. You know, he'll get a lot of minutes at number nine. I actually think Ten Hag will have to use Rashford at nine a bit as well, just to kind of allow Højlund to assimilate a little bit more, just to kind of bed him in a little bit easier, which I'm fine with. But yeah, I just think expectations need to be tempered. And from a fan base that is very easily led to delusion, I'm concerned. Well, I'm not really concerned. They'll be like, he'll be fine as a player and they'll be fine as a team. But it feels like the narrative around him when he comes back with 13 goals all comps at the end of the season, a lot of people will be disappointed.
I think he'll be better than that. But yeah, I do, because I think he's just going to play a lot. You know, they've paid this money to start him. And I think, you know, Brennan Johnson played all last season and got 7 goals in the league for Nottingham Forest. I mean, people are hyping him up on that performance, which I do not understand. But, you know, 7 goals playing all season up front for Nottingham Forest. I think that, you know, Højlund's going to be playing up front for United. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. It does depend whether he's like the nailed on starter. It depends whether Ten Hag does other stuff. It depends if Antony's fit. Not Antony's fit. Anthony Martial is fit. But yeah, I know what you're saying. Like, he is primed to fail and to be called overrated, overpriced at the end of the year. And actually, if in 3 years' time, you know, it's a little bit like the other day I saw like a football Twitter thing where people were comparing like Vinicius to Saka, and you know, people are like, you can't compare Saka to Vinicius. Vinicius is way better. And I was like, Vinicius is better. Vinicius is also 2 years older. And Vinicius only started kind of getting good
about 2 years ago
when he was around the age Saka is now. Yeah. Well, if Højlund has like 2 to 3 years of being a bit slow and then explodes, then it will kind of be stupid that people have spent those 2 to 3 years comparing him to Haaland, who's older than him and more experienced than him.
Have people just forgotten that all the criticism Vinicius had like 3 seasons ago?
Yeah. So I just think it's one of those things where people always want to compare guys where, you know, like one is hitting their prime and one is just starting out. So yeah, you're right. I can imagine people being like, well, Højlund had 3 hat tricks by now and Højlund's only got, you know, 4 goals. Yeah.
I think the comparisons, the expectations are too high and people have just forgotten how young and inexperienced he is. He is a project. Yeah. He is a project. He needs time.
He is a project. Right, let's go on to mine before we hit the burn book. Sandro Tonali.
Yeah.
Don't get it. Do not get it.
He doesn't get it either. Have you seen him?
Oh God,
he looks fucking miserable.
From Milan to Newcastle, like it's just. He's a Milan fan since youth, but obviously Milan got this bid and they were like, "My boy, you are going to Newcastle."
The biggest fall from grace since Icarus.
And this is, thank you. That was a good one. I just think Eddie Howe has got hold of the checkbook this summer and has gone buck wild. Like, now, to be clear, I like Harvey Barnes as a signing. I like Livramento as a signing. I don't like the Saint-Maximin sale. I literally don't understand why people have decided Saint-Maximin's crap.
Yeah,
I was talking about this the other day. People were like, Saint-Maximin, though, he's rubbish. He's just rubbish. Like, Harvey Barnes, big upgrade. And I was like, Saint-Maximin's better than Harvey Barnes.
Yeah.
He is. Harvey Barnes might be a better fit, so fair enough. But like, Saint-Maximin's a better player. Anyway, but they've overpaid for every one of these signings. And Sandro Tonali at 40 mil, I'd say, oof, don't know about that. Like, when he was young, when he was at Brescia, and people really liked him because Brescia kind of has that history with like defensive midfielders. I think Pep was there playing defensive midfield. Then Pirlo was there playing defensive midfield. And they were like, new Pirlo, Sandro Tonali. He's going to go from Brescia to Milan, where he's, you know, he's been a fan of Milan, and he chose Milan over Inter and over Juve. And the thing is, sometimes these sorts of players, people will say, oh, the stats can't capture what's good about it. People used to say about Pirlo. They were like, you know, what Pirlo's great at is never going to show up in the stats. Bullshit. It showed up in every stat. Yeah. Like, Pirlo had lethal stats. Like, genuinely. Like, I've never heard anybody talk as, like, rapturously about Pirlo as Ted Knutsen of StatsBomb, who like, used to rave about him and put up his radar once, and it was a fucking umbrella. Like, it was crazy. He's so good. But Tonali doesn't, like... Newcastle fans are defending this because Newcastle fans are now turning into the most thin-skinned fans in the world. But like, tell me, what is Tonali meant to be good at? Like, what actually is he meant to be good at? His passing's good. It's all right. His passing's okay. Like, low pass act, not a problem for a pressing team like Newcastle. But four final third entries, five progressive passes, not as good as Bruno. Nowhere near as good as Bruno. Created two chances a game last season. Three quarters of the chances he created were crosses or dead balls. Defensively, completely average. He runs about quite a bit. But I just look at him and I'm like, what is this guy good at? And that's not to say he'll be bad necessarily. I'm picking him as my biggest flop, but he might not be. But like, if people say Eddie Howe is going to turn him into something, I'm sorry, but when you spend 70 million on a player, it shouldn't require your manager to fix him.
A product that's already finished.
Exactly, and it's the same as my objection to, like, Kai Havertz. Like, Arsenal paying 65 million there for, like, a reclamation project when they could, for example, go and get, like, Mohamed Kudus for, like, 40 million. Yeah. Now...
Ceilings are different Havertz, there, though, in my opinion.
I agree. And, like, I'm not totally against the Havertz move. Like, I think he might well be a really interesting signing for Arsenal this season. But Arsenal paid a prince's ransom for a guy who needs to be fixed. And you could use that same money to get a guy who doesn't need to be fixed. So, for instance, they could have gone and got Szoboszlai for the same money.
But also, I think fixing Havertz isn't really fixing Havertz. It's just not playing him as a centre forward.
Sure. And to be fair, Havertz does have a track record of amazing stats. Yes. Like, his output in Germany was incredible, which Tonali doesn't have. But anyway, my point is just that, like, for this sort of money, Newcastle could have either got two good players, like above average Premier League players, or they could have got one incredible player. And I look at this and I think 108 million between Harvey Barnes and Tonali. Well, Moussa Diaby went to Villa for 55 million euros. So you could have got Moussa Diaby and like Lavia. You could have got somebody like Nicholas Jackson, Moussa Diaby, and probably a 20 million midfielder. Like, you could have done all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess they might be expecting they're going to have more possession this season. Teams are going to sit deep against them. They're going to need a guy who's more of an on-the-ball midfielder. Tonali's going to be a bit more used to that. But but 70 mil on him, 38 mil on Barnes, 40 million on Livramento, who I think is amazing, but is recovering from a serious fucking injury.
Also, can we not forget about Anthony Gordon as well, please?
Oh, boy.
A lot of these seem like Eddie Howe, just being like, this guy's a good player, let's go buy him. Like, dude.
And also, not just saying that's the guy I want, but nobody eventually saying, Eddie, this is the maximum you can spend on him. Yeah. As talented as Livramento is, we are not going to pay 40 million on a guy who's had one good season in the Premier League and then had like a cruciate injury for a year. We are not going to spend 38 million on Harvey Barnes after he's been relegated from the Premier League. Like, we if we're going to spend 70 million on a central midfielder, like, we can do other stuff. We could go and get like Tielemans and somebody else. It's almost Caicedo money.
Yeah.
Like, do something else. So, I still think Newcastle have a good season. Maybe not as good as last year. I don't quite believe it. Especially their stats at the end of the season, which kind of juiced them quite a bit when they were one of the few teams still trying.
I think their biggest problem is that other teams will be better than they were last season. I think the reason they finished so high was because a lot of teams that should have finished higher had shit seasons. Or at least long stretches of the season that were shit.
Yeah, and I think teams will just play differently against them. Yeah. I think teams will just be like, we know what you do. And that doesn't mean we can necessarily beat it, but it means we're not going to play into your hands.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, that's my shout. Shall we move on to the burn book? Okay, on to the burn book, everybody's favourite segment. And I actually was kind of out of the habit of doing this. So, can I start with what I'm taking out of the burn book this week?
Yeah, be my guest.
Because I'm not that proud of it. It was a bit of a struggle. I don't know if you recall this, but when I was a kid, there used to be this thing about wearing the colour brown. People would kind of laugh about it. People would kind of say it was like 70s. People would kind of be like, oh my God, he's wearing brown. Like, somebody's wearing a brown suit. That's embarrassing. You
With suits, I get that. Define kid. Sorry, like age range.
I don't know, like 10.
Okay. I don't remember that, but I do remember when I was like 17, 18. Brown suits, I was like, that is a shit suit.
Yeah, and now I'm like, brown suits are the coolest suits. Like, a brown linen suit, get that on me. But like, there was this whole thing about brown, and I think still there's this kind of like idea that brown isn't a cool colour. I don't know what it is. Anyway, this is a minor thing, but I feel like now my wardrobe is like 50% brown.
Exclusively brown.
I love brown clothes. Like, I think they're great. There's a whole Instagram account that's dedicated to just like Jeremy Strong from Succession wearing brown because he like loves wearing brown. But I don't know. I think it was this one of those weird holdovers from the 90s. You know, like people who think that if they use margarine instead of butter, then they're going to lose like 30 pounds. Like, no, you're not. It's worse for you than butter, if anything. It's full of weird shit. Like, I just think that...
like the fucking Atkins diet as well. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember the Atkins diet and everyone was just like, oh, it gives you really bad breath. And I was like, that doesn't seem like a good trade-off. Like, anyway... Yeah. I think that generally becoming an adult is about shedding some of the prejudices that were impressed upon you as a young person. Yeah. And there still was a little bit of me, a small part of me. Like, if I was wearing navy blue, okay, here's the thing. If I was wearing navy blue head to toe, no one would think about it.
Oh, I would.
Certainly no one. Okay, yeah, I'm not a big fan of navy, but you would.
I'm not a big fan of people. Navy on navy. I think navy on navy looks a bit weird, but sure. Sorry.
But say you're wearing like a navy shirt, say you're wearing blue jeans, and you're wearing like, I don't know, some sort of blue shoe. I don't fucking know.
You want blue shoes?
I don't know. And a blue jacket. I don't think people would like stare at you on the tube. But the other day, I was wearing a brown t-shirt. And I was wearing these like tobacco brown like Service Works trousers, which are actually a real kind of like rusty
reddish. Love Service Works.
It's so good, man.
I don't have any of them. I don't own any of them, but
they're comfy.
I am constantly on their website.
Yeah, on the Blacksmith store.
I just love it. I also love the branding on it.
Yeah, me too. That's what I like the most. Like the chef's pants. Yeah. Like, they're just cool. Like, and And they're like completely reasonable as well, like price wise, which I think is a big draw of workwear. I think workwear should be reasonably priced.
Yeah, like Dickies.
But yeah, exactly. But like I have those and I was wearing them the other day and like two people were watching me from across the road and like the guy was like quite fashionably dressed. So I was like, okay, I think that you're like trying to decide like what how you feel about my outfit. Like you're obviously the kind of person who looks at people's outfits. But I thought this would not be noticeable. No one would look if I was wearing all blue. They probably wouldn't look if I was wearing all green. They wouldn't look if I was wearing, you know, probably tan, like even like, you know, like beige. They certainly wouldn't look if I was wearing black. Like nobody would really care. But because I'm wearing brown, it's like, it just feels different. Brown hasn't quite entered that realm. But brown is a neutral color. Brown is a neutral color.
It feels more aggressive than neutral though.
I know, but why?
I don't know. With the prejudice.
You see what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's one of those things that starts silly, but actually as time went on, I was just like, it is weird. Like brown is like a completely normal color you see in nature. Like it's not like, if I was wearing red head to toe, you could understand why you'd look at me and be like, Jesus.
Yeah.
But if somebody's wearing brown, then you're just like, it's brown. Like you're looking at me differently than you'd even look at me if I was wearing all green. I think
my biggest problem with this isn't the brown. My biggest problem with it is the outside of black is the head to toe same color.
Sure.
I need some break up. So like I have a lot of tan trousers, like cords or Dickies, whatever, and then a lot of tan short coats.
Okay.
Never wear them together because I think it's too much sliding from one tan to another tan that's almost the same color.
Yeah, I think there needs to be a difference. But I mean, say you're wearing like a kind of like warm, say you're wearing like a really dark brown.
Yeah.
You know, like the dark brown of like,
here. Because also a light brown is tan.
Yeah, exactly. So like, say I'm wearing tan and then a brown shirt and then I'm wearing a really dark brown like overshirt, then they look like three different colors. It's a tonal look. Like it's not like, is that guy wearing a suit?
Yeah, it's like, it's like a color, you know, palette. Yeah,
exactly. So like, anyway, I just think it's a bit of a weird one.
Yeah,
so I mean, what have you got? What are you taking out?
It's interesting because I very rarely wear brown. I wear tan, but I don't really call tan brown.
You need to bring brown in. And honestly as well, like I've been quite early, I've been selecting an outfit for your wedding next year.
Oh really?
I actually bought a new jacket.
Is it gonna be brown?
It is actually brown. Yeah. But I mean, you know, like I'm going to wear like a jacket and trousers rather than a suit.
Yeah.
Because this jacket is incredible and I want to wear it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it, as you approach summer, spring summer, I think it's nice to have like that kind of look.
The wedding is in Northern Ireland, by the way, in April, just, you know.
Sure.
To dress for every single element, because it's all possible.
It's not warm weather. I mean, it's not like linen. It's all formal wear. It's going to be a formal look. You know, I'm not going sockless.
Oh no. But just be aware that it could rain, it could snow, it could be 25 degrees. It could be everything.
It's wool. It's going to be wool head to toe. But yeah, I was just like, I want to do something with brown here. I want to wear like a brown jacket. I'm going to wear like some grey trousers, but where I think that the grey is sort of enhanced by the brown. Like, I just want to do something fun. I want to wear a fun tie. And like, I think brown is like an amazing background color. And I also think sometimes it should be the star. And the service work trousers, if you go and look at Service Works website and you look at their brown classic pants, they're this brownish red. And I'm just like obsessed by them.
Yeah, I really like the coats, like the chore coats. They have like
they're great.
Whatever. I mean, I'll probably end up buying one, but like the last thing I need is another chore coat because I've got like six.
Sure.
But yeah, sorry.
I just bought a new one.
Yeah, they're just so versatile. They're just fucking great. Okay, so that was what you took out. Okay, so you're forcing me now to start positive, which I'm fine with because I'm really happy.
Well, then we can end on a low note.
Sure. I'm really happy about my entry. And I've been sitting on this since pretty much the week we finished our last episode. What I'm taking out of the burn book are air fryers.
Yeah.
Do you have an air fryer?
I'm waiting until we move into a bigger house, so I will have the counter space for an air fryer.
Okay, well, Patrick, you've just given the perfect segue because I resisted. Jess has wanted an air fryer for ages, and she said, we should get an air fryer. Because it's been about, what, 2.5 years since the air fryer has kind of risen to the top.
Yeah,
kind of covered
max, I would say.
Like, it feels like just after, mid-21, air fryers came on the market and people started raving about them. And it kind of felt like a weird cult that people were in. And I resisted it for a long time because, you know, we just don't have the counter space. Like, Jess has a Kenwood mixer that's out on the counter all the time. We have, like, my coffee machine. We have microwave, all the normal stuff. And then also when we moved into this house, one of Jess's non-negotiables was a range cooker, which is big five-burner cooker that's, like, probably just over a meter wide and has three ovens in it, or two ovens and a grill. Like, it's a bulky thing. So that also eats up a certain amount of potential counter space. So she was always fighting to have an air fryer. And I was like, you just don't have space. Where would we put it? One, we don't have a counter space for it. And two, we got this really, like, high-end, expensive, beautiful range cooker that you love. If we buy an air fryer, we're going to be using that less. And I resisted for, like, probably over a year. And then Amazon Day came around, and it hooked me in. I was lying in bed at like 11 o'clock one night and just saw that Amazon Day was there, and I got served air fryers, and I was like, okay, maybe I'll look at like some reviews. Maybe I'll look at like a Witch article. What's the best one? What could we use
it
for?
No, once you're looking at the Witch article, the decision's made.
I was like, what could we use it for? How would it enhance our lives? And I found a good one that probably would have been best suited for us. Went on the Amazon to see if it was in the deal, and it was like 40% off, 40-50% off. And I was like, it's now like 100 and something quid, down from like 300. If we're going to buy one, now is the time. And also, at this point, Jess wasn't pushing it. She was like half asleep. This was fully me just getting caught in consumerism, in capitalism. So I was like, fuck it, right. She made a case that we move the microwave into the utility, because we don't really use it that often, and replace it with that. And I was fine with that. So we bought it, and we started using it. And I am very comfortable in saying, I don't think I've been more wrong about something in my life.
Damn.
Perhaps that is largely because I'm very rarely wrong. But in this instance, I was so wrong. Because as an invention, it is unbelievable. So some of the highlights of the things I've cooked, I haven't cooked anything like outrageous, but just getting some baby potatoes, quartering them, some salt, some pepper, some garlic, some rosemary, chuck them in the air fryer. So like a tiny bit of oil, like 5 mil of oil. Chuck them in the air fryer for like 15 minutes. Oh, fantastic. Like crispy, like half, kind of roast potatoes, kind of chips. Beautiful. Fried chicken, right? But like, not fried chicken as you know it. So, like, chicken tenders you whisk an egg. And do you know what the coating is? Obviously, your seasoning, but your coating, like the breadcrumb coating. It's not breadcrumb. Yeah. Well, I'm not using breadcrumbs. Cornflakes.
Yeah.
Okay. Get them in the pestle and mortar, crush them down.
By the way, if you saw my attention waver, then it's because I was adding, I have a note which is like stuff to buy when we move into a new house.
Air fryer.
And I was just like moving air fryer to the top. Yeah.
But like whisk an egg, chicken goes into the wet, goes into the crushed cornflakes. Obviously, you've got your seasoning in there as well. I'm not just raw dogging it with cornflakes.
I'm
cultured. Into the air fryer for like, I don't know, like 12, 13 minutes, flip them once halfway through. And is it as good as normal fried chicken? No. But is it almost as good? Kind of. Like, it's probably 80% as good, but it is almost infinitely healthier. Fried chicken for me is always a thing. It's like my go-to cheat meal for everything. I have a digital print. Mm. Jess's mom got me a print of Morley's for Christmas.
Nice.
Which is a chicken shop in South London, because I'm like so obsessed with it. But it's always been largely off the market for me if you're trying to be not incredibly unhealthy.
Yeah.
And the same as like chips, same as a lot of those things that are kind of branded as unhealthy or bad or kind of like cheating. And I don't really like the term cheating anyway, but yeah. They've all become so much more accessible because the amount of oil you need to use or the ingredients that make these dishes bad are almost exclusively removed
from
air frying. Because it's the oil is pretty much that. It's like the fat.
Yeah, because like chicken is like low calorie, high protein.
Chicken breast
like
is really
fat,
lean.
Like,
you know,
like some cornflakes, you don't need that many to like, or breadcrumbs, you don't need that many to like coat it. An egg is like 70 calories.
Chips, like potatoes. Potatoes are not like baby boiled potatoes. If you boil your potatoes in water and salt and eat them, nobody says that's unhealthy. But if you fry them in oil and make them chips or make them like roast potatoes in like goose fat or whatever,
yeah,
a lot less healthy. Whereas this recreates it really well, 80 to 85% as accurate or authentic as the real thing. And it's just way healthier. So yeah, I've just been like smashing fried chicken wraps for lunch a lot of the time.
Oh my God. And even just stuff like steamed or boiled broccoli is fine. I like it fine. But roast broccoli with crispy bits, amazing. Yeah.
Or fried.
These smashed Brussels sprouts people doing. Like, all that kind of stuff. Like, if you... Quite often, all you need to make a meal a bit more fun is for it to have a bit of, like, crispy texture.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite hard to do that without frying or without roasting for ages. And you need oil to do that.
Because the thing is, like, if you eat unseasoned potato or unseasoned chicken, you're not sitting there eating it being like, oh, this is amazing. It's the seasoning and the texture that elevates whatever the I suppose maybe like steak might be one of the exceptions, but sure. So if you season it well and it gets crispy in the right places and moist in the other in the right places, like it's going to be good. It just depends. So the parameters that make the difference are how healthy is it, how much oil are you using. They're also super easy to use. Ours is two trays. Yeah. Like, two things can cook at one time. Also multifunctional, 8 different functions. I can bake croissants in one.
What?
So it's got a bake function, it's got a grill function, it's got a dehydrate function. It can dehydrate. You can put something in there. It takes 8 hours, not done it, but you can dehydrate in it.
Sure.
I'm not sure about, I've largely not really looked past the air fry function, if I'm honest, but it has many functions and two different compartments, so you can do multiple things. Honestly, it's a really good invention. Would definitely recommend an air fryer. I thought it was a cult. I thought it was hype. I thought it would never live up to the kind of the billing and the reviews and how people would rave about it, but I was wrong on all accounts. If you can get a good air fryer for like 150 quid or less, do not think twice about buying that. Figure out where you're going to put it later. Just buy it.
All right. We'll do it. Like, I mean, we've known we're going to do it. Like, it's never been a debate. Because especially we were thinking, once you have kids and your kids get older and you've got to sort, like, supper for them, you can't stand frying a thing.
Yeah.
And you also don't really like having, like, pots on the hob too much as your kids get bigger.
Yeah.
So, like, being able to be like, we will put this in the air fryer and in, like, 20 minutes, like, we will have... I don't know, some nice roast vegetables, basically, and chicken.
It really is like the equivalent of like what a slow cooker is. You chuck it in, leave it for this set amount of time, and you come back and it's done. Also, the cleanup is just like two little trays and the little bug. Like, they're pretty much wiped clean. You just wipe them, you rinse them, wipe them clean, put them back in.
All right, I am convinced.
If you think about the amount of faff that you would need to shallow fry chicken in your kitchen.
Oh, there are loads of, like, Emma has made me fried chicken at home before.
Even just like, disposing of all the
scratch.
Oil. Fucking mental.
And it was amazing, but I was also kind of like...
Such a faff.
This is fucking stressful.
Yeah.
Like, we could have just ordered this. Like, yeah. And then we would have... more of our evening together. Yeah. You know,
and nothing to clean up other than the utensils we used.
A bunch of boiling hot oil in our house, which I could like honestly do without. Okay. I'm going to kind of resurrect something for the thing I want to put in the burn book. I know that last year I talked quite a lot about like thrifting and buying secondhand. But I want to talk about it specifically in the context of tailoring. So what I want to put in the burn book is buying cheap suits off the rack.
Okay, right, yeah.
So I think a lot of people, they're like, I wear a suit once or twice a year. Or shit, I've got a wedding coming up or whatever. I'm going to go and buy the cheapest suit I can. And if they're really, really like, are a bit wary of tailoring because they don't know how it works, which a lot of people don't, you know, like there are loads of silly rules to tailoring, then they might go to like a high street shop. Or even like an M&S, which I guess is fine. If they want to put a little bit more effort in, they might go to a sort of, you know, Moss Bros, Charles Tirrett, like, you know, like an actual suit shop, TM Lewin, like that sort of thing. Get a suit from there, which is definitely a step up, and you can get nice suits from those places. But the thing about tailoring is even a cheap suit is still really expensive. If you went and bought a suit from like H&M, it would cost you like £150. Like, they're really expensive regardless of where you get them. And given that they're expensive regardless of where you get them, it makes much more sense with tailoring, more than almost anything else, to get it secondhand. Now, obviously, I think generally you should get things secondhand. But in the case of suits, you can get suits that you would never have access to as a normal person. If you know your measurements, and it's pretty easy to work out your measurements, you can either measure a garment you have that fits you, or you can measure yourself. You could go to a suit shop like Moss Bros and get them to fucking measure you. It's like not that hard. Just go in and try stuff on until you find what fits you, and then like know that you're that size. Then you can shop for all this stuff secondhand, online. On eBay is actually really good for this stuff. But if you look at places like Vinted, you can get bigger bargains because people there don't know what they're selling. So if you go on Vinted, I saw the other day a jacket sold on Vinted that I had in my save just because I was like, I don't really want it, but like I want to see what happens with this. And it sold for £12. And it was a sport jacket from Canali, which is, you know, an amazing Italian suit maker. It was fully canvassed. It was made of wool, silk, and linen. It was like 44 regular. It was completely normal size.
Yeah.
And you could have worn it with any smart trousers and looked amazing. £12. I saw somebody selling a New and Lingwood suit. New and Lingwood is like a Savile Row tailor. Their suits are about £1,000 new. I saw somebody selling one for £28, the full suit, immaculate, because their dad didn't want it anymore and he asked them to get rid of it. So they sold it on Vinted for £28. Now, if you know your sizes, you could go and do this. And the thing is, if you're spending 20, 30 quid, 50 quid, maybe 60 quid on the suit, you can afford to spend the remainder of the money, which would have gone towards buying that suit new, on alterations. Even if you're like a really weird shape, it's going to be hard for you to spend more than about 150 quid on alterations. That would be a lot for you to spend. Generally speaking, you might have to have a sleeve changed. You might have to have like maybe the waist taken in, trousers taken up or like let down. You're probably looking at, if you do all that, maybe 100, 120. You don't have to go somewhere expensive. Well, 120 plus the 50 you've spent on the suit, you're paying the same or less than you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit from just a high street shop. And what you're getting is a top-quality suit that has been altered specifically for you versus a suit made of, like, wool polyester or viscose or something.
Mass-produced,
which will not last as well, which will not last. Because also it will have like style elements of it that will go out of fashion, and more importantly, the fabric, the construction will be bad. Instead, you can get something that's very classic and will last you forever. Like, you can wear a suit jacket for 50 years if you look after it. And when I say look after it, I don't mean like in any special way. I just mean get it dry cleaned occasionally and pressed. Like, it's really fine. They're built
to last. Keep it in a
shit
bag, and hang it up.
Yeah, and they were made by artisans. Like, there are amazing suits out there that were made by people who know what the fuck they're doing, by tiny little Italian men who know what they're doing. And they put effort into these suits because they're expensive. They built up layers of, like, horsehair and canvas and all these things to give them structure. Like, a lot of work has gone into them. They shouldn't go in a landfill. Well, you can go and get one and you'll look amazing. And if you're wondering, okay, well, if I go and get, like, you know, a Canali, like, suit from the 90s, am I just going to look like I'm in the 90s? No. Like, most of the stuff in tailoring, most of the basics have been timeless. Yeah. If you get a two-button suit, so it's got two buttons on the front, it might have three, but basically you want the lapel to go past that first button and only button the middle, right? I think the ones where the lapels are really short,
yeah, and, I don't like them.
You know, you button the top two. I don't like that. I think that is a bit dated. Wait. But even padded shoulders, which used to be a joke as well, no one really cares anymore. Like, I've got a tweed jacket with really quite padded shoulders because it is vintage. I don't care. Like, it doesn't bother me because it fits me really well. So if you get a suit that has just, like, wide-ish lapels, not super thin, that has, like, a button, a middle button on the front that you button rather than, you know, like, some weird configuration of four or three, that has been cool from the 1950s and still is. Like, that's still good tailoring now. Whereas actually, if you buy suits now, and I know there's, like, the menswear guy on Twitter who I love, but who's everywhere at the moment, and, like, so people have obviously seen him talk about, like, suits. But modern suits are really short and they're really tight. So you often see somebody wearing a suit where the jacket doesn't cover their ass, which is the one thing it should do. It should cover their ass. It really bunches up around the sleeves, or it just doesn't, or you see the lapels kind of buckling away from the chest because it's too tight. Just don't do that. All you need to make sure is that the trouser hangs cleanly and that the jacket covers your ass and that the sleeves and legs are the right length. And that's it. Like, if I prefer the high-waisted trouser, but you don't have to do that. Like, there are all sorts of individual preferences that you can choose whether you care about them. But if somebody got in touch with our podcast and said, buy me a suit for a wedding, here's my size, I could literally go out on, like, Vinted or eBay or Depop or whatever, and I could buy them a suit and I could say, take this to a tailor and get it, like, altered to your size. And I guarantee I could get that to come in at under £200. And what they would have in return is, like, a timeless, super high quality suit, because I've seen stuff sold on eBay for a pittance. I have a suit from eBay, and I know my sizes. I'm gonna have this altered, but I bought a suit from eBay for £60 that normally goes for about £800 with alterations. I think it'll probably run me about £220 all in. But it will last me forever, and that's just because I was like, you know what, I have suits, but I don't actually have, like, a more muted suit. Like, if tomorrow there was, like, a funeral I needed to go to, I wouldn't actually have a suit appropriate for that, in my opinion. You know, so I was like, I'm going to get this one. It's cost me nothing up front. And I have short legs. Like, I have relatively short arms. I have quite broad shoulders. Like, I'm a more unusual shape than some people. If you're just tall and you're just, like, a 40-inch chest.
Oh, my God, you're going to be killing.
And, like, a 34-inch waist, you can literally pick up an immaculate suit that will fit you tomorrow, made by Caruso or Canali or Southwick or fucking, you know, Brooks Brothers or whoever, or Polo Ralph Lauren, like, whatever you want. You can pick that up for nothing. Honestly, nothing. And I think it is the ethical thing to do so that we don't put more shit in landfills and kind of support fast fashion. I also think it is supporting the work of artisans who are really good at their jobs. And ultimately, I also just think you will look better and spend less money. I can't recommend it enough. So all it takes is a little bit of measurement. And if something arrives and it's not quite the right size, quite often you can return it. If you're just starting out, just only look for people who accept returns on eBay. It's fine. Or you can get it altered, and most alterations can be done. There are a couple that you wouldn't really want to attempt, but the majority of alterations are quite easily done, or it doesn't matter that much. Like, no one's going to notice. Basically, if the jacket fits your chest and shoulders and the sleeves and trousers are the right length, no one will notice any of the other stuff that, you know, menswear nerds care about. So I just can't recommend it highly enough. Like, I have a Canali blazer. Like, I have a Roderick Charles suit. Like, I wouldn't buy those brand new because, like, they're a little bit expensive in my view. But I have them now.
It's interesting how you turned a section almost into a second out.
Yeah, that's so true. It's actually, like, yeah, I did.
The what you're taking, what you're putting in the burn book is buying suits off the rack, but the TED talk that we just TED talk that we were just exposed to was more of why you should buy vintage suits and get them tailored to yourself.
Yes, definitely.
But it is invaluable information.
Thank you. I honestly would love it if somebody ever wants to run this as an experiment. If someone wants to, like, get in touch with the podcast and say these are my sizes, find me a suit. I will send you a suit on eBay and you can decide whether to buy it or not, but I will send you two or three options and I promise they'll be like Italian made high quality shit,
and we can cover it on Anything But Football on Patreon.
Yeah, and then you can come to Pete's wedding. Wear it to Pete's wedding. Oh my god. Okay, should we wrap up the free side, because we've got another podcast
to do. I mean, I still need to put something in the burn book.
Oh shit,
I'll be super quick though. Right, we're going let's try and aim under 2 minutes here. Under a minute, right? Mine's super quick because
because I hit your time.
Not even that, but mine was going to be quick anyway because there is no defense to what I'm going to put in the burn book. And what I'm putting in the burn book are people who don't return their trolleys in the car parks of supermarkets or, you know, like B&Q hardware stores or the garden center, whatever. People who go in the supermarket or whatever shop they do, get the trolley, fill it up, pay for the stuff, come back to their car, put the stuff in their boot, and then just leave the trolley beside their car and drive off, instead of, like, a normal, respectful, non-abhorrent person wheeling it back to, like, what, 40 meters to the nearest trolley station and putting it in with all the other trolleys, instead just leaving it in the middle of a car park, in the middle of a space that will probably, like, stop somebody parking in that space. Somebody might open their door in, not see it, open their door into it. Just the arrogance of being like, oh, some of the staff will come collect it.
Yeah.
No, shut up. You took it
it's
out.
It's beneath me.
You took it out. Fucking just go put it back. It's not even difficult. It's not like you have to walk the whole way back to the shop either. Like, they generally have little huts dotted all around the car park to make it really accessible for you to return your trolley.
Yeah.
Like, the amount of effort you need to go to return your trolley is so minimal. The fact that you're saying that you can't do it is just ridiculous. And there's a really fun Instagram account called Cartnarks, where basically it's just this guy who wears a GoPro and, like, it just lingers in supermarket car parks in America as well. So it's even better. Like, the interactions are even better. He lingers in car parks with the GoPro and just, like, waits for somebody to ditch their cart, their trolley, and then just goes and calls them out on it. But what's interesting, though, is when they do that, the arguments that people have for leaving their carts is insane. Like, they never justify it. They're just like, well, I'll do what the fuck I want. Like, fuck you. Like, it's just so...
Yeah.
It's so ignorant and disrespectful. And it's like, the fact that you think somebody else is just going to pick up after you for no reason. Dickhead. Take it back. Yeah, it's not hard.
I agree.
Not hard.
I also think this about people who leave their, like... you know, like the rental bikes you have in London and the rental scooters, the people who just leave them, like, blocking a pavement.
Oh.
They just get off them and, like, walk off.
Yeah.
And I just think...
Be more considerate.
I'm just going to kick it over. Like, I'm going down there with a pram. Well, when I'm going down there with a pram, it's fucking annoying. But I can at least stop the pram, move the bike, and then carry on with the pram. Like, what if I was in a wheelchair?
Yeah. Like, in the middle of it, yeah.
And I'm sorry, but, like, it doesn't matter how much of a dick you are, like, really? Like, do you really want to do that to other people? Like, I don't know. Is it just your way of, like, proving how hard you are, that you're just like, I just don't even care about the social contract? It's just like, you know, it doesn't make you hard. It just makes It makes you like a try-hard little bitch that you think, like, this is how I look tough, you know, by leaving my bike wherever I want. Grow up.
Yeah, it's very, like, secondary school rebellion type
exactly.
behavior. Yeah. Yeah, but, yeah, dickhead. No time for them. Be more considerate. Well, it's not hard.
Literally no time for them because I took all the time. Okay, that is our free podcast for today. We will hopefully see you over on the subscription side. If you're not subscribed, then head to patreon.com/patrickvs and you can subscribe at the $6 level, which gives you access to 2 more episodes per month. It also means that you can submit questions through Patreon. This week's episode, you know, should be a good one. We're going to be talking about some of the big moves of the summer. So we will see some of you over there, and the rest of you we'll see in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you very much for listening. Bye.